what I'm telling people all the time is it does not matter what that black person's voter propensity is. It doesn't matter how likely or unlikely they may be to vote. It is a good bet to engage them, period, because the enthusiasm is so low, because anything less than 100% of expected turnout of black voters can absolutely be catastrophic this year because the coalitions are so thin, so threadbare, so fragile. Every black voter engagement, registration, GOTV pull through, every bit of that is valuable and worth doing with enthusiasm.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. For today's episode, I get the chance to catch up again with Tamer Mokhtar. He's now running a group called All Americans Vote, which works on voter registration of African Americans. They do an interesting job of partnering on technology, organizing, and evaluation with other groups in the space. We talked about some of the recent efforts in progressive political entrepreneurship and what he thinks works and why he's chosen the focus he has on registration. It's always interesting with Tamer. You should listen. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, my interview with Tamer of All Americans Vote.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
So Tamer, normally, as you know, I ask people to introduce themselves and give a biography, but in your case, you've been on the show before. We've talked through a lot of your history. Would you mind catching me up with what you've been up to since we had an episode back in July of 2021? What you've been up to and what's the main thing occupying your talents in the political space these days?
Yeah, it feels like that was ages ago. More than anything else, what's happened is we've really sort of honed in on what's most important and where we can make the biggest impact. Look, that sounds pretty cliche, but the metaphor I use all the time is where can we drop a pebble that will cause the biggest sort of tidal wave? And it really has focused more and more in on black voters, black voter engagement, black voter turnout. About a year ago, we launched something that we're calling the Black Midterm Voter Project because there was this phenomenon that we recognized was sort of hidden in plain sight, where black voters who turn out at exceptional rates in presidential election years, turn out at exceptional rates during special elections, the fall off in midterm years is hard to understand and more significant than just about any other singular demographic block. So if we can address that change and zero out the difference between presidential and midterm years with black voters, then you end up with long-term and permanent change in terms of the accountability and responsiveness of elected officials and all the things that flow from there. And to call it the Black Midterm Voter Project is a bit of a misnomer because it implies that we're only focused on midterm cycles, but the experimentation and learning is year-round every year. We've really focused in on that. And as a result, we have a couple of things that we're flying with in 2024.
When you're using the term we, who are you talking about?
All Americans Vote is the 501c3 that I co-founded with Reid Hoffman back in 2018. Still work in close company with a lot of the old players from the Investing in Us days, Dimitri Melhorn and Ray Stewart and Ben Rellis and Steve Butto, a bunch of people that have been in this fight for a number of years. But this is a standalone 501c3 voter engagement, black voter turnout focused entity now.
And is Reid helping fund that?
Oh, for sure. Reid has backed all of the research and undertakings that we've engaged with so far. And by the way, it's a hybrid sort of funder-doer model, right? We still look for the founders that are doing the best work and try and put gas in their tank so that we can refine and iterate on really promising hypotheses. But in terms of the doer side of it, it really is a matter of layering in what we have learned over the years, not just the work that we've done, but that has been done more generally by other players, and seeing what can be complementary and what types of initiatives, proven initiatives, can be coupled to augment each of their own sort of individual effects.
Before we get into more details about All Americans Vote, that group of people that you've just mentioned, what other things are they up to that you can share?
Oh, they're up to all kinds of stuff. I mean, look, have a conversation with Dimitri and slow it down, and you'll learn that like he's kind of everywhere in terms of what he's looking for relative to the genesis of human behavior and how it translates into the way people respond to all things now. Really important work in the area of urban youth, right? Because one of the things that has emerged is as you start looking at population densities in certain areas, the behavior and proclivities of people, there's a point of delineation when you reach a certain threshold in terms of number of human beings that live within a square mile radius of one another. There's also like a very interesting set of facts around the way young voters engage and behave and act if incentivized, if engaged in specific ways. So the combination of all of those things bring forward like massive opportunity and also a massive, massive undertaking. This began in 17, actually, when we started looking at this idea of generating a culture of celebration and poll parties and early vote festivals and all that type of stuff. And this is just, you know, several generations of experimentation removed from that is kind of where all of this has landed now. And there are a couple different versions of that that are sort of live and in the wild now.
Anything in the area of political technology still going on?
So I used to be pretty heavily involved with like Higher Ground Labs and New Media Ventures and so many of those investment hubs that we're looking at and incubators and accelerators. I honestly am a step removed from that now, but one of the main technologies, one of the main developments that came out of our initial investments in 2017 was Pushblack. Everybody that's probably listening to this will have some familiarity with what Pushblack is, but the growth and the level of success that they've had has been insane, and we're integrating them still in what we're doing because they have like this infinite curiosity and a massive reach. So having grown from 500,000 subscribers to something like 7 million now since we first engaged with them, and all of the things that they can do, like that is a technology, and what they essentially have is a list of engaged Black citizens, and their ability to engage them in effective ways has been off the charts, and it continues to be. And now we're looking at ways to capitalize that, just new ways of capitalizing on the engagement that they've been able to garner.
So All Americans Vote goes back a little bit. Characterize the organization right now. How many people are working there? What are you trying to do, and what would we expect out of you in the 2024 cycle?
Yeah, we're small. So between full-time staff and advisors, is about a half dozen of us. But what we also have is kind of full-scale contracted initiatives with teams like Headcount, teams like Think Rubix. So respectively, one of them builds all the tech that we're applying to one of our massive initiatives and does all of the follow-through, and we're working intimately with them. So they're sort of the tech team on the backside of this thing. Think Rubix is sort of the creative and collateral generation and some of the marketing that we're doing to potential partners. So it's full-time, it's advisors, and then it's contracted folks. So that's the size of who it is that we are and what we're doing. But we like to think of ourselves as scrappy and able to, you know, produce some real gale winds with the thrust of our lungs alone.
When I talked to Think Rubix back in 2018, it was Tijuana Thompson. Tell me about what they are up to these days more generally.
Yeah, so Tijuana Thompson is still CEO over there. She is just this remarkable force of nature. From everything from like big strategic thinking to the nitty gritty of how to pull together an entire campaign. For example, one of the big things that we're focused on this year is engaging in rural northeastern North Carolina. This is going to sound random as heck, but having spoken with Tijuana for years and working with her and many other Black organizers for years, there is this market opportunity in a cluster of about 17 counties in that area. The makeup of these counties is between 32 and 60% Black. There's almost no outside investment in these areas. It's chronically under-resourced, and they are chronically under-engaged. And people like Tijuana have been sort of beating down my door for years saying, look, if the stars aligned and we had unlimited everything, this is an area where we think we could make a massive, massive difference. So I have Dawana now, basically untethered. And I've basically said, okay, challenge accepted. Let's make that massive difference. And what does that mean? Why is WokeVote so good at it? We're literally staffed up right now. And they've already been in the field. They've already canvassed six different counties. And Dawana, coming from all of the work that she's done in Alabama and other places, called me about a week ago. She said, I thought I knew what rural was. This is rural. So this is real. But, you know, the fact is they're on the ground now. They're canvassing these counties. They're already having relationships with elections officials. They've already learned about all of the different cultural things that are taking place in those counties. Because as you may or may not know, when you're in a place that's so sparsely populated, everybody will know everybody. And this is the definition of, like, make an impact with one, you're making an impact with many. So we're trying to break the mold of communities such as these who say, well, you either are never around, or when you do show up, you show up 3 weeks before an election. It's an extractive type of relationship. What we're doing instead, actually, is we're investing in those communities today to learn as much as we can about them. We are actually hiring people from within those communities to do a lot of this work. So scale takes on a whole different meaning when you're dealing with that kind of sparsely populated area. So when you employ a few people, when you provide provisions that are at very, very low cost but high impact in those areas, it goes an awfully long way. So we're trying to build an awful lot in that way, and we're coupling with folks that are already in that space. But the main point of it is they engage intelligently from the beginning, and we are for sure trying to make sure that if that's a live experimental area, if that is untouched soil, let's go ahead and go all in with it and see what we can do. And just so you understand why the juice is worth the squeeze in this scenario, there are about 240,000 voting eligible Black folks in these 17 counties. All right. They turn out in presidential years around 12% less frequently than their white contemporaries in the state of North Carolina. The math works out to where if we just get the Black voters in those counties to turn out at the same rate as their white counterparts across the state, which is not unusual. It is not unusual for Black folks to turn out at the same rate as white folks. It's not unusual for them to actually exceed white voter turnout. But if we can just flatten that gap, that's about 26,000 additional Black votes that will be realized in a swing state in a presidential year. And that's something.
I talked to a woman named Cynthia Wallace down there. Have you run into her? She ran the New Rural Project, and she was dealing with some counties in North Carolina.
I haven't come across Cynthia yet. We are working with Sarah James, the Rural Democracy Initiative. They have Resource Rural. They have the ability to take a look at federally available funds that are untapped in areas such as these, because either they're unaware of them or they don't have the capacity to look into where some of these resources can be applied. And we are looking for exactly those kinds of opportunities where, let's say you can repurpose a warehouse and turn it into a training facility where there's federal funds available to produce stipends for people to upskill in things like solar power installation and maintenance. By the way, I'm not making that up as I go along. Resource Rural, with whom I've been connected through the Rural Democracy Initiative, actually did that in West Virginia. And to have 30 people in a repurposed warehouse learning a new career path because they were sick of working in the bakery or being a handyman, that's the type of impact in that type of area that can resonate very, very loudly. So those are the types of things that we're looking to also see about, you know, opportunity areas where we can bring some of those resources to bear.
You mentioned headcount. I know a little bit about that from talking to Andy Bernstein, who used to run it. I think they had a turnover at the top there. He was connecting a lot of people in the entertainment world with the voting world. How do they play into what you're working on?
Yeah, so Lucila's now at the head. I don't want to butcher her last name, but she's remarkable. She's come in at the head of headcount, worked with people in Tappan, Vickery, Lee Van Put. These are some very, very intelligent people that have done the type of voter registration and voter engagement work at scale that has produced just outstanding results. For example, they did a thing called Good to Vote with, again, a friend of ours named Ben Rellis, where they did just unique ways of engaging people. They had YouTube influencers that were doing sweepstakes, all these creative sweepstakes, like giving away a Tesla. Or Sam Jackson said, if 1,500 people check their voter registration as a result of this video, I will curse on video in 15 different languages, you know, you know, stuff like that. It was just fun and creative. And what they were able to show is not only did they get millions of engagements, not only did that translate into hundreds of thousands of new registrations, they were able to turn out many of these young voters at rates that are 20 to 25 percentage points higher than the national average. That level of efficacy is just remarkable. Now, what is the refinement? What is version two? What is my version of that? Where am I using headcount there? So the other initiative that we're doing, so I've already mentioned North Carolina, the second of two things that we're undertaking this year is something we're calling turn up and turn out. So in the past, we did poll parties and early vote festivals and vote concerts and all that kind of stuff. And what we learned, and I think it's pretty intuitive, is it's pretty hard to get a whole bunch of people to come to a place for a thing, right? And if you really want to make sure nobody shows up to a concert or a party, call it a vote party, right? No one wants anything to do with that. Instead, what we are focusing on right now, and we've gotten just insane traction already, is where do these centers of gravity already exist? Think your local jazz festival, black music festival, homecoming step shows. There's all kinds of food festivals in cities where there's a center of gravity around black folks that are showing up to a thing. Day parties, seersuckers events in Atlanta and Richmond, Virginia, all these different places where these events already take place. Partner with them. And here's where it becomes interesting. A really good iterative version of this is, hey, when you set your tickets to go live for pre-sale online, we can integrate through Headcount a coupon code. So click here, check your voter registration, get 20% off or $10 off the price of admission. Or enter a sweepstakes to win a full VIP suite to next year's event for you and 10 of your friends. So these are events, by the way. There's a Pittsburgh Black Music Festival with whom we're in contact that draws 100,000 people over the course of a few days. The city of Detroit has these parks and recreation where they have 7 or 8 festivals over the course of the summer, along with 29 different chapters of Black Creek Letter organizations that are all doing events. They want us to partner with all of those. So over the course of time in a city like Detroit, you end up engaging literally 30, 40,000 Black folks with this same general idea, then apply Headcount's musculature and their ability to not just get them to check their registration, but also pull them through, get them all the way through to the act of voting. We're talking about really significant differences here in terms of Black voter engagement, registration, and turnout. This is one of those things that's really, really exciting.
One of the things I'm hearing that's very interesting to me from you is this notion of putting together multiple building blocks of different progressive organizations with different developed expertise, different having people who've run tests in the past who know different things that when you, from the vantage point of American, all Americans vote, can say, I want a little of this, and I'm going to make a program out of it. Tell me about how you develop that notion of how to be effective out there.
It's kind of the crux of the approach, right? It's this idea of layering concepts. So over the course of many years, and if you go into like the AI library, or if you attend any of the webinars, or you listen to all the different experiments that are being run, a couple of truths have emerged, right? And one thing is that we know that relational organizing is one of the standard now best practice that should be applied wherever possible, where a warm outreach is X times more effective than cold outreach, right? Culture of celebration, that's another thing that holds tremendous promise. And while it's hard to execute, if done correctly, can move the needle in significant ways. Social pressure is another one of these tried and true, proven, you know, it's inarguable what the data shows as it pertains to social pressure. So all of those things combined, like picking and choosing where these things are applicable, is exactly what we're trying to do. So I mentioned Push Black already. So that's a siloed relational organizing program, essentially. What I mean by siloed is if I'm a subscriber to Push Black, I'm engaging with Push Black, but it's just me and Push Black. I'm not in community. What happens if Push Black, with their 7 million subscribers, which are everywhere, what happens if they can geofence to that cluster of counties in North Carolina? And what happens if they can take the folks that are engaged with them and shunt them into that woke vote campaign or a local campaign where there are real life community members that are doing real life community organizing events? So can we take somebody from what we're calling from URL to IRL and impart to them one of the characteristics that is more indicative of a super voter? I'll back up for 1 second. One of the things we learned in this comprehensive literature review that we did with AI was that the profile of the American super voter, the person that is most responsible for upholding our democracy, is a middle-aged Black woman of a certain income, of a certain level of college education, that lives in the suburbs and has a political or religious home. If you see that woman, give her a hug, because she's very much responsible for towing American democracy along and sort of standing it up. Now, of all the characteristics I just conveyed to you, we can't change somebody's age, gender, how much money they make, where they live, or, you know, what their college education level is. But if we can impart that characteristic of a political or religious home, in this case, a political home, where they're in community and they're now engaging with other people that where conversations about politics, activity around politics, activity around civic engagement is okay and safe and energizing, we may create more super voters. And that can radiate outwards to great effect. So this is where we're layering concepts. We know what relational organizing is. We know what having a political home can do. We know that Push Black has this massive outreach, and Push Black is really interested to know whether or not they can do what we're proposing here as well. So this is where the layering of concepts comes into play across everything that we're trying to do.
You used the term AB, and I was thinking, because I'd read a memo on this, that you're referring to the AB partners. Is that right?
Yes.
Tell me about how are they fitting in?
So this is another question that makes me very, very happy to address, because there's something that needs to be understood writ large, and that is across the entire ecosystem, Black organizers in particular have a well-founded and well-deserved level of cynicism or skepticism around objective metrics, around the way certain measures are taken and the way data is set up. There are biases. There's all kinds of controversy around the way turf is cut and all that kind of stuff. So we have people like AB Partners coming in, examining that what we're calling Operation Push Block, because the pilot version of that is happening right now in Milwaukee with Angela Lang and Block Wisconsin and Push Black. And we're going to transfer it over to North Carolina in 24. But to have AB Partners on the front end looking at this work, we worked very hard to make sure that we had as much Black representation in the investigative side of things as well, as a side note. But to have them transparently setting this thing up and letting them know, okay, what is possible? What might we be able to observe? What are the learnings that can come out of this, good, bad, or neutral, from the very, very beginning, does a couple of things. It has the potential to validate whatever it is that comes out of this. And it also allays the fears of the operators about this boogeyman that is this outside observer. The other thing that we're doing is, with the three live experiments we ran in 23, I used three different investigative entities very intentionally, because for me, it's a matter of like spreading the pain. If you hate Analyst Institute, you probably don't also hate AB. If you hate AB, you probably don't also hate the Movement Cooperative. So it really is a matter of making sure that we're letting people know transparently and openly, we have to observe these things. There has to be an objective metric assigned to what it is that we're doing. We have to be able to prove that what we did was done in a way that is worthy of scale, abandonment, or iteration. And in so doing, by having multiple entities looking at it, it's a good faith effort for the collective to say, these are communal learnings, and we're going to open source them to whomever it is that's interested in learning more about this. And we will continue to do it in this way, so that we can sort of defang this idea of the biased data sets or whatever it may be, to whatever degree we can.
So is that a reaction to criticism that you've received in previous cycles about, hey, you guys are very analytics oriented in how you evaluate different things, and we don't think the analytics are capturing the right things? Did you receive that kind of criticism? And is this you working to make sure that you don't have that in future cycles?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. But understand, we're never going to get rid of it, right? There's always going to be some version of that. If you want to watch a riot take place, just enter the phrase cost per net Democratic vote in any progressive gathering, right? And just watch the Royal Rumble occur. The problem is, contextualizing it all means that nothing is gospel, right? You have to have directional instruction, right? You have to know, at the very least, I'm heading in the right direction, or I'm way, way off base. And this idea of cost per vote, or whatever the metrics are, help you in that way. You cannot operate with blinders on. Nothing is the be all to end all, but there have to be checkpoints. You have to be able to attribute cause and effect in order to justify any future action, investment, etc.
Yesterday, I got a message from a friend of a friend who sold a company for a giant amount of money in the last couple of years and is interested in doing something in the 2024 cycle and had been connected to me because I do this podcast and the friend we have in common knows that I think about this. And he wants to talk about, like, where should I put money in? Now, this goes exactly to that cost per vote question that you're mentioning. And I think it is a very hard question to answer. Even the more you know about it, the more you realize that nobody fully has a handle on it and that sometimes it's just not even determined. Like, you don't know if you put some money into opposition research and somebody taped a meeting where Mitt Romney said something about 43% of the people, that might end up being a 5 million vote swing on the taping of one conversation. That's a pretty unpredictable thing. There are other elements, tactical things, where you could get a better measure on it. But there's lots of things that are strategic where it's hard to predict, or one thing might matter one cycle and not another cycle. You've now accumulated with your group of people that have worked with Reed, and you've been through a lot of cycles thinking about what does work. If you were going to advise someone new on the scene with some money to spend on the right side, what would you tell them?
Yeah, so this is going to sound like it's self-interested, but it isn't. The evidence points to, in this cycle, the set it and forget it destination for money is in Black voter registration, period, point blank. Aaron Strauss proselytized this recently. There's a coalition, a collective group of sort of data wonks that look at all of these things. And Black voter registration is still the most effective use of a dollar until it is totally maxed out. By the way, this has been true in recent history, that in terms of the bang for the buck, that's where the money should go. Why? Number one, the Black voting bloc is known to vote, if you're interested in partisan breakdowns, votes at a rate of about 90% for the Democrat, right? Generally speaking, for the Democratic Party, most generally speaking. So there is no singular voting bloc that's even close to that. The next closest is probably like sort of 2-1. So the net Democratic vote for the, you know, young folks is like 67% Democrat. So the net vote there is plus 30. With Black voters, the net vote is plus 80, conservatively.
Can I just stop you on that for just a sec? Because my sense has been that those numbers are historically true, but that there's concern that current polling doesn't show them at that rate. So what that indicates to me is, like, previous strategies of let's just mobilize these people blindly are not right, that there has to be a persuasion aspect. This time around, not only do we want you voting, but we want you voting for the Democratic ticket. Do you see that? What are you actually experiencing in those different areas?
As you can tell, I'm enthusiastic about this conversation because the persuasive effect, whether it's persuasive or reminder, we can talk about that in a minute, that's a little bit further downstream. And I've had this conversation with a lot of people. Terrence Woodbury is a good friend of mine. He started Hit Strategies and he talked about this. And I saw him give an interview where I gave him some pushback. And what he was talking about was exactly what you're referencing. There's a narrative out there right now that Black voters only, whatever it is, put whatever assigned number you see today to it, only 70% approval rating of Biden or whatever it may be. And the conclusion from there is, if you're only getting 70%, if only 70% of Black voters are voting for the Democrat, you're screwed. Well, that would be true, but I think you're conflating two issues. What we're talking about there is interest level. So it's not that out of 100 Black voters, 30 are going to switch and vote for Donald Trump all of a sudden. What you're finding instead is out of 100 Black voters, only 70 of them will turn out. And that's where it can be catastrophic. So if 70 turn out instead of 100, even if you get 90% of those, the pie has shrunk to such a degree that it can absolutely be catastrophic. That is what is different this cycle than before, because what I'm telling people all the time is it does not matter what that Black person's voter propensity is. It doesn't matter how likely or unlikely they may be to vote. It is a good bet to engage them, period, because the enthusiasm is so low, because anything less than 100% of expected turnout of Black voters can absolutely be catastrophic this year because the coalitions are so thin, so threadbare, so fragile. Every Black voter engagement, registration, GOTV pull through. Every bit of that is valuable and worth doing, and worth doing with enthusiasm. So
is it worth doing and saying you should register to vote, you should vote, but also Cornell West is not a good option?
Yeah, well, listen, for sure. I mean, for sure. But so you have to understand, in terms of voter registration, the thing that also makes it valuable, if you really want to break it down, is that you can, in fact, target by virtue of demographic, which makes it a nonpartisan endeavor, which makes it even more valuable in terms of cost.
You can use cheaper money.
That's exactly right. You can use cheaper money. The dollar will go a little bit further. Now, when you get to the point of having to persuade, that's a different argument altogether. But I want the top of that funnel as stocked as I can get it, right? And that's kind of the point here. Just get every single human you can, every single Black human you can, into that conversation, and then worry about the other thing. Because if you don't have a big funnel at the very, very top, it doesn't matter how precise your persuasion campaign is. You didn't start with enough to get down to the number you need.
Well, in that regard, in stocking the funnel, it's a big country and there's a lot of contested areas. And if you're working in part of North Carolina and part of Wisconsin, you're leaving on the table lots of other funnels where just Black people live, for example. What is stopping you from applying the headcount model to concerts in Phoenix or in Detroit or in any of the other states that are contested or the congressional districts or Senate? What is keeping the scale? Well, you've talked about only a couple places. Do you plan to expand beyond that? How are you thinking about that?
So I was unclear. That headcount model, we are applying everywhere that matters. So that's why we have that work in Detroit that we're finalizing now. That's why we have that lead in Pittsburgh. So in terms of the rural Northeastern North Carolina model, that is the other thing that we're doing. We're doing two concurrent initiatives. So that ground game and everything that we're applying to rural Northeastern North Carolina is because that is a very specific market that is primed for outsized impact. The headcount model is literally applicable anywhere. The only limitation, and the best thing about it, is costs are basically fixed on that. So the more I spend, it just means that means we've engaged more people. It is a per engagement type of, it's a linear relationship there. All of the mechanics are already built. So the only limitation there is the amount of money that we have to back up the initiative. And right now we've raised a fair amount. There's literally no ceiling to this. If we get more than one of these 100,000 plus patron events to sign on board, I'm then going to start beating the bushes saying, look, we could use effectively $2, $3, $10 million more dollars, because here's exactly where it will go. And here's exactly how it can be used, because it's already set up. So there's literally no ceiling to what can occur there. As it stands right now, it's just a matter of, you know, it's a sales process as much as it is anything else. We've got partners lined up in a number of different cities, and they're referring us to more and more folks. So the more of these events to sign up, the higher the ceiling goes.
I mean, another way to expand the funnel, as you put it, would be to step outside of the Black electorate into other Democratic demographics, even if they're only 2-1, like you say. Is that something that's off the table for you, or do you see other people doing that well? Or give me your thoughts about that.
Yeah, so it's not my particular area of expertise. I know enough to be dangerous, but I'm always fearful or mindful of mission creep. So I want to make sure that what we do very, very well. And by the way, it's all contributory, right? So when I talk about 26,000 votes in rural North Carolina, right, that's not enough to swing the state. The delta in 2020 was 74,000. But I'll tell you what it does for all the billions of dollars that are pushed into suburban white women and swing voters and working class white voters. My challenge to my friends like CJ Grimes and folks that are doing that kind of work is, you flip your 30,000 votes, I'll bring you these 26,000. And as the English would say, Bob's your uncle. That's the difference. That's in the aggregate. That's the difference in terms of what the math tells you. So in instances, going back to the event-based stuff, like, I had somebody come to me and say, hey, look, there's this bluegrass festival that attracts a pretty liberal audience, blah, blah, blah. What do you think about this? And I say, I don't know the first damn thing about bluegrass. I wouldn't know the biggest star in all of bluegrass if he was sitting next to me at the lunch counter. I have no idea who that might be. But if that's a good audience for it, let me refer you to somebody that might have an idea, and you all take it from there. So I don't limit the conversations, but it's not the best use of our expertise and resources to go into those spaces.
On the other side of the aisle or ideological divide, Trump has a history of bringing out voters that have been less likely voters in the past and surprising us in states with turnout that exceeded the calculations that we had about what it would take to win. Does that play into your strategy at all? A concern that we're not going to just need your 23,000, but we're going to need a chunk more than that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. By the way, I accept that as a given, that that is going to be the case. He's a turnout monster. Now, I hope, and I think there's evidence to suggest that he's not going to have quite that impact this cycle that he's had before, but I'm not relying on that, right? Like, the Dobbs decision has proven to have real legs and has proven to really, really eat away at some of those margins. There are a couple of other things at play as well, but assuming that he's going to continue to have the impact he's had in the past, you know, we just have to go. That's why we've been doing these, executing these innovations. That's why we're trying to make the impact that we're having. And by the way, I may have shared this with you before, Nathaniel, but the way I summarized 2018 and 2020, like the quote unquote blue wave of 2018, was imagine winning a foot race, right? And like a 100-meter dash. And the person that came in second broke the previous world record. That's what 2018 was. That was his turnout capability. And if we hadn't done literally everything we did and all the massive numbers that we saw, if every single bit of that wasn't put into play, that second place was enough to win any other election prior to that one. So I am operating under that same assumption here in 2024. It's why we're doing what we're doing.
When I asked you if you had a whole lot of money, where would you put it? You said, well, black registration. What would be next on your list? Or how would you go about thinking about where else? Like, let's say we maxed out this very important area, which what you're focused on, and that would take a lot, obviously. But say we did, how would you go about figuring out how you could have impact if you $100 million to spend or something?
Sure, sure. So I'd run this, obviously, to full optimization. The idea of going into being more intelligent about engaging the urban youth is really, really interesting to me. The numbers are really overwhelming because we talk about it being a big country, but as we all know, it boils down to a very finite number of areas and to a very finite number of areas within those finite number of areas. So you just look for the market opportunity that has the highest ceiling. And the very, very high ceiling as it pertains to all things with all the variables thrown in, once again, has to do with young voters in urban environments. And the reason that's important is because for all of, again, the massive turnout we saw in even in 2020, urbanicity was an indicator of lagging voter turnout relative to rural areas. I don't recall the exact citation, but after 2020, I remember looking at this, major metro areas showed between 5 and 14% lower voter turnout than rural areas. So it's but for the fact that the gross number is so much bigger that you see the gains that you have, but it also is a big indicator of higher market potential. So I would really take a look at how do we engage in that way? How do we get in there and optimize everything in those spaces? And that's a big, big undertaking. That is a $100 million undertaking. There are ways of doing it. It's a very, very heavy lift, but it's worth doing.
If you're looking at urban youth, and I think if you talk to a bunch of people in that category, you might hear things like, Biden is old. I don't like what's happening in Gaza. There are these interesting third party candidates who I could be more pure by voting for, or I could just sit this one out. I'm not loving what I see going on. One of the ways you deal with that is policy change and communication change from the top of the ticket. Other ways you deal with that when you're in the campaign space is by talking to people in different ways and recognizing some of these realities about this particular cycle. Do you have any thoughts about what the presidential campaign should do to work well with the people on the ground? Do you have any thoughts about what the people doing the work should be doing to be more persuasive to people who have these kinds of doubts?
this is the $64,000 question, because I think it keeps us all less than comfortable in our private moments, right? No matter how enthusiastic we are about whatever it is you're dealing with, these are issues that are really difficult to tackle. The Israeli-Palestinian thing, I tell people all the time, this is a sleeping giant in Michigan, for example, because we underestimate how deeply this issue really runs within the Muslim and Arab community.
And beyond. Yep.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, it's just, so just from a Machiavellian, strictly mathematical point of view, as close as Michigan was in 16 and 20, to lose that coalition or some significant portion of that, that's the state gone. You know what I mean? And how do we get that back? I don't know the answer to that. I will say that you have to apply everything we know about effective sales and marketing. So in other words, you got to figure out a way to empathize. I've heard certain people talk certain ways about, well, you got to get over it. Well, look, maybe that's ultimately what you're going to be asking somebody to do. But boy, that's probably not the best way to open the conversation. You know what I mean? And what I've told people as we've spoken about it, and I don't know the answer, but I will say, look, you cannot add a but or at the end of any qualifying statement and expect anybody to take you seriously. In other words, to say everything of October 7 was bad, but what the Israelis are doing is genocide, doesn't do anybody any favors, and it's factually inaccurate. The best way to approach that is to say, the things that happened on October 7th are inexcusable. We need to figure out what has people in a mindset or a level of desperation to where they've justified in their mind that kind of action. And are we going to get to the source of that? Are we going to try and figure out a way to bridge those divides? I don't know. And by the way, that may be too heady a conversation to have in the context of a door-knocking campaign. That's a serious quagmire, man. I don't know how to dig out of it other than I think the obvious end game answer is, who do you think ultimately is going to end up being better in the situation? You know, a guy who has said, go take over whatever country you want because I feel like this person hasn't paid me enough money, or the person that's actually thoughtful and may have made a misstep or a gaffe or hasn't said exactly what you like, but is at least thoughtful about this and trying to err on the side of human dignity. You know what I mean? So it kind of comes down to that. But by the way, none of that shit fits on a bumper sticker, Nathaniel. And that's part of the problem.
It is. And in fact, that kind of anticipated what was going to be my next question, which is, you know, and I know, and a significant portion of the country knows that the risks that the current House and former President Trump pose to this country and the world are dire. But there's also, I would say, a majority of the country that can't hear that, doesn't hear that, doesn't believe that, doesn't operate in that kind of intellectual frame, has different lenses. It's almost like we're in a situation where the most clear argument for why we don't want these people in power isn't necessarily the argument that's going to work. Does that mean we should try to figure out a better way to tell that? Does that mean we have to worry mostly about these tactical things? I feel like we are sleepwalking into a catastrophe.
Oh God, I use that same phrase. I worry to death about that. Since the beginning of time, this has been the problem with Democratic candidates and progressive role. I mean, we speak in, like I just said, none of the stuff that we talk about fits on a bumper sticker.
People are smart. You know, like people might not be schooled in history and don't know about Mussolini and Hitler and Stalin and Putin, but there's got to be some way to bring home what the threat is here in a way that can be believed.
Yeah. So no, I mean, look, this is the whole game. I mean, how many people can actually define what fascism is? How many people know what the policy of appeasement was? How many people actually know what is taking place in the context of history that aren't like steeped in it, right? The vast majority of people will not. And I'm not insulting the intelligence of the American electorate. What I'm saying is, we're not doing a good enough job of answering the question of so what. This is, by the way, applies to all aspects of business. Every time somebody thinks that they're making a really, really good statement, if you can't answer the end game question of so what, you haven't done enough. You know, you got to save democracy. So what? What does that mean, save democracy? Democracy is going to die. Okay, so what? What does that mean? And if you can't follow it all the way through to where it matters to you and me, then you're in deep trouble. So let's take the example of the economic indicators. And boy, unemployment is down and, you know, GDP is up and all these things. And the average American is going to ask the question or not, more dangerously, so what? All I know is my eggs, my milk, and my gas are expensive, right? Well, guess what? Gas is pretty cheap right now. There was a national commercial during the NFC Championship that Wegmans put out, or it must have been a regional commercial, where they said, hey, things are starting to normalize. We are passing on the savings to you. We are reducing our prices. So now a bag of chips costs a little bit less. Eggs cost a little bit less. Milk might cost a little bit less. And God damn it, if Donald Trump could get out every single day and claim credit every single time the Dow took an uptick of a percentage point, even though he had nothing to do with it, why isn't Biden out? Why isn't every single surrogate out talking about how fast food is now cheaper, the value meals are coming down, eggs are cheaper, milk is cheaper. Thank you, President Biden. Like, if you can't do that, and if you can't do that at the beginning of every sentence, as the precursor to every answer you to give, no matter what the question is, as a surrogate, spokesperson, or principal, then you're missing a trick, because that's what they did every day until they were blue in the face.
So in the world that you can have some control around, because we all have only our small parts in this big drama, is there any part of that national messaging that goes into the kind of all Americans vote tactics, or is that sit aside it without reference to all of these big debates?
Yeah, these are nonpartisan endeavors we're undertaking. So we're having a conversation on a personal level. The undertaking I'm leading is C3. So what I'm focused on is that funnel that I referenced earlier, right? The job of that messaging belongs to somebody else. I clearly have opinions about it, but it's not anything that I can do without ending up sort of in deep shit. So we are here to expand the funnel of Black voters. We are here to engage more Black voters. And then hopefully folks will understand how to take that and do something with that supply, so to speak. I mean, that's a crass example, but in terms of, you know, commodities, widgets, whatever you want to call it, in this case, it's voters, we're focused on that. We're trying to increase the opportunity to turn people out.
If you wanted to compare how you feel about our prospects now versus our prospects at the same point in the cycle in 2020, what do you think?
That's a really good question. I don't want to say this out loud, but I think our prospects are, every time I go through this exercise, I twist myself in a pretzel. I like to think that our prospects are a little bit better because we have seen the impact specifically, and this is almost gross to say, but the Dobbs decision, like bodily autonomy with women, means an awful lot in terms of the broader electorate. It has bucked all predicted trends in terms of, you look at the election cycles of 2020, 2022, specifically 2022, like it bucked some serious, serious trends. And that's not going anywhere. So there's that. I don't personally think the indictments are going to amount to a hill of beans, but I think that the Trump base is shrinking down to its core. I don't think there's a whole lot around the periphery of that Trump base. By the way, that's my hope, not my strategy. So my hope is that at the end of it all, he's going to end up with a solid 35% of the electorate and no more.
I mean, based on what? That's not polling. That's not.
I have very, very hard time putting any stake in the polling that we're seeing right now because, you know, national polls don't amount to a thing. The election is 650 years away in terms of political lifespan. You know what I mean? So I don't base that on a whole lot of polling. This is my hope, not my strategy, as I said before. The biggest problem that I see is, let's say the election is won and the numbers are undeniable. That doesn't mean the Capitol won't be stormed again. We didn't know what that sentiment was actually capable of manifesting come January 6th. That was not on my bingo card. I did not know that kind of thing was going to happen. I'm not imaginative enough to figure out what's next if and when he loses again.
Well, look, it's pretty easy to imagine that if he loses again, it's problematic and that he may do some out-of-the-box thinking and that he has dangerous supporters. If he wins, he could win outright without cheating. he could get more votes. And then we have a absolutely enormous problem of all of the weight of the government being turned to his ends and pushing every limit, breaking every norm again, but this time knowing how the doorknobs work.
Not only that, but knowing there's literally no consequence. Like, what he has learned is there is no consequence.
He's much less likely to be impeached, having turned the Republican Party into a group of sycophants. What worries me is the number of people who are going to have regrets post-election when they see what really is going to happen, when we potentially have deportation camps and the civil service turned upside down and many other things happening, but it's too late. At least it's too late to stop it without much, much heavier costs and much steeper hills to climb.
Yeah. So what you're describing is there is a significant chance that any of those scenarios and any number that we can't even think of are actually in the offing.
Putting the military on the streets.
100%. Every single one of these things, like you and I could be vulnerable. We could be seen as subverting, treasonous, bad actors.
That's what happens in other countries that go down this road. That's what happens. It doesn't happen probably on day one, but leaders like this in many places keep pushing for more absolute power.
Yeah. And the challenge becomes the frog in the boiling water scenario. Like, the streets aren't going to be flooded with dead bodies. And
the streets might be flooded with people celebrating that they have the big guy in charge that they wanted.
Yeah. This is the type of thing. I had this conversation with a friend yesterday where I think some of those lessons will only be taught in history classes 20 years from now. We won't even realize it's happening. And I've talked to some people that think it's already done. There are people that you and I both respect to think, it's wide-eyed optimism to think that any election is going to actually take place and be free and fair anymore. Democracy is already dead.
I don't think it's dead. I think it's not a spectator sport. I think what the future holds depends on what people like you and the people that you're working with are doing. And I'm glad you're working on it. When you look at that ecosystem of the people fighting, does it make you optimistic? Does it make you feel like we've come up short?
And that's a question I would love to pose to you as well, because I'm amazed on a daily basis at the talent of the people that are in this thing and what they're willing to put themselves through and the things they've left behind. There are people like Alistair Martin, who started VoteER, who's a doc up at Mass General, who I believe at some point in his life was like homeless and failing out of school and then put himself through Harvard and Harvard Medical School and everything else. There are people like Chris Hollins, that's like a civil rights attorney down in Houston. There is an amazing amount of talent and intellectual horsepower and soul and desire and commitment on our part. Jeremy Smith over at Civitech, another one of these guys, it's like a superhero in regular clothes. You know what I mean? Like, that makes me incredibly optimistic, because I am awed all the time by just the sheer horsepower that these people bring to the fight. It doesn't make the situation any less bleak, but it does mean that at the very least, when the barbarians are at the gate, I've got one hell of a squad that I'm standing shoulder to shoulder with to keep them at bay.
We have a pretty good team. When you look at the other team, what do you see?
Maybe this is a failing of mine that I haven't spent as much time really investigating who they are. And emotionally, I have so much disdain for anybody that can rationalize being on that side of the fight. I am not able to divorce my personal feelings about them, because they look at me and don't want me here. You know what I mean? Everybody on that side, no matter how smart or talented they may be, the one thing I know is they don't want me here. They don't want my kids here. They don't want my family here. They don't want millions of people that look like me here. I don't deserve what they have. So in that case, I should be more ruthless about learning more about them and figuring these things out. But to be honest with you, I'm just trying to bolster my side of this thing to whatever degree that I can and not run in the red constantly by thinking about, I'm trying not to grit my teeth here, the sheer lack of humanity that motivates, at the crux of it all, that motivates the other side and what it is that they're doing in service of whatever glossy veneer they're trying to place in front of it.
You have this group, All Americans Vote. You're working on, among other things, getting out the black vote through registration and other tactics. Do you think that if Trump picks Tim Scott, a black male senator,
it
affects anything?
No. Listen, man, you heard the phrase, they're skin folk, but not all skin folk is kinfolk. Like, Tim Scott does not move the needle. I mean, he will maybe in some little ways, but there's nobody I know. There's nobody that knows anybody that I know in the black community that looks at Tim Scott and says, you know what? That brother's all right. No, I hate to be this dismissive, but I am in fact this dismissive of Tim Scott affecting anything.
You don't think it takes away you're a racist card if Trump can say, look, VP.
That's what he thinks it'll do. That's why he would do it.
Yep.
But no, hell no. Look, the answer is no. I'm giving my folks way too much credit than to fall for that particular piece of okie doke. Like, that's just, that's not going to cut it. It's not going to cut it.
Well, it's always fun to talk to you. What should I have asked you that I failed to?
You got me all fired up at the end of this thing, man. No, listen, what should you have asked me? You asked a really good question about where should money be spent. I think the question that I would love to grapple with and talk with you about more is, with the amount of talent that's come into this, have we overachieved? Have we met expectations? Have we come short of those expectations?
For my 1,000th episode, as you know, I've asked former guests to ask me some questions, and that was one of the ones that you sent me. So I'm going to hold my answer on that to that episode.
Yeah.
Not that I, have one.
Right. So listen, I think the question you maybe should have asked me was, what have you tried and failed?
Okay.
Right.
Let's do that if you have time. What have you tried and failed and learned from?
Yeah. So I tried a thing in 2023 with this interfaith coalition in the state of Virginia that had like a couple of hundred congregations of several different faiths. It was a network, right? It was a really strong kind of distributed network. And some of these houses of faith had 50 congregants. Some of them had 5,000. And what I thought was, hey, can we turn this into like a Girl Scout cookie sale type of model whereby, you know, we got an election year. Can we recreate a positive environment of competition through social media, et cetera, with this already developed coalition of congregations whereby, you know, First Baptist Church says, hey, we've registered 85% of our congregants. And then the AME church down the street says, well, we just registered 30 more today. And like, there's like this back and forth, this banter that can sort of the rising tide and all of that. I thought that was a really interesting initiative. And we really went into it pretty deeply. The bureaucracy at place within houses of faith, and there's a lack of trust. And it was a really tough hurdle to clear, to let people know that we're not manipulating your data. We're not monetizing your data. We're not sharing your data. All we need is basic stuff. We couldn't overcome that in the 6 or 8 months that we were trying to execute this program. So while I felt the hypothesis was super promising, the hardcore logistics of trying to make it happen made it to where it's not something I can justify taking any further. So that's a failure that, at the very least, I learned something from it, and I wouldn't do it again. Happy to pass that to somebody else that's willing to give it a shot, though.
Having worked for or with one billionaire who's on the right side, and knowing there are others who are aligned with us, do you have a feeling of, among the super wealthy, how the balance of expenditures and influence is going to shake out in 2024?
Yeah, this is another really hard reality. And that is, the land has really dried up in terms of fundraising. That landscape is really, really difficult. There was obviously this massive amount of interest in the last 5 or 6 years. The problem becomes, like, going into 2018, it was like, the urgency is now so that we can learn for 2020. Going into 2020, it was like, the urgency is obvious because of this. Democracy won in 2020, and now it's version two of it. And most of the new entrants into the world of donating large sums of money, were not expecting to be signing up for a lifetime subscription. And many of them were going to be just fine, regardless of who wins the election on a personal level. So it takes a specific, really, really heightened sense of empathy and altruism to be that involved over that consistent a basis, over that long a haul. And there are very few of those folks. I mean, that's a rare combination. So it's a tough landscape. I think people are going to come in. People are becoming more aware by the day that this is a reality that is once again right in front of us. And hopefully, the PTSD of 2016 through 2020 will spur enough folks to come back into the game for where they've retreated back to what they were hoping was going to be some semblance of normalcy, which clearly has not turned out to be the case.
Is there anybody out there who you think has a firm grip on that balance of power who could talk to that in more detail? Like, I think about the reporting at Puck or sites like that. Teddy Schleifer's put some legwork into talking to people in the very high dollar fundraising or donor community. But it seems, like a lot of these people don't want attention to what they're doing.
No, I think most of them don't. I'll put it this way. Like, Trump has name-checked Reid recently. You know what I mean? And that leads to problems of its own. Nobody wants that kind of attention. No one's asking for that kind of attention. And by the way, you don't have to do anything wrong to garner that kind of attention.
No.
You know what I mean?
He takes random swings and he doesn't even understand a lot of things. So just being
in the Those random swings can have in many cases catastrophic fallout.
You know? But if we all shy away, if Republican politicians buckle under because they're afraid for their careers, if everybody is trying to get out of the way of the random haymaker, then we just surrender as a country. We can't be doing that.
You're preaching to the converted on that. I mean, I'm one of many people that left behind their careers to get into this. So I don't disagree with you in the least. It's a more complicated proposition, even with those that are sentimentally with you, to get them to actually take that step. I don't have an answer for you, Nathaniel.
Yeah. We do have a lot at stake. It's a worldwide problem. So I hope that the people who have influence and power recognize that in time.
So do I. And I appreciate you for banging the drum.
Tamer, anything else you want to say?
No, I think we've covered it all.
That was Tamer Mokhtar. Tamer is at allamericans.org. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. The Great Battlefield is now part of the Democracy Group Podcast Network. Visit democracygroup.org to learn more about other podcasts that cover democracy and civic engagement. You can also help me by leaving comments and good ratings on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere, and by sending me suggestions for great guests to nperlman@gmail.com.